And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, if you've been watching the news, there are riots and demonstrations everywhere about the vaccination demands. And the powers that be are in danger of losing that power that they worship so much. And I'm sure we'll see more in the coming days and weeks. Well, today's October 20th, 293rd day of the year. 72 days remain till the year's over with. Spanish soldiers wade through 15 miles of water in one night to effect the relief of ghosts. 1740, France, Prussia, Bavaria, and Saxony refused to honor the Pragmatic Sanction, and the War of the Austrian Succession begins. Now, for those that are not familiar with it, the Pragmatic Sanction was an edict issued by Charles VI, the Holy Roman Emperor, to ensure that the Habsburg hereditary possessions that included the Archduchy of Austria, the Kingdom of Hungary, the Kingdom of Croatia, the Kingdom of Bohemia, the Duchy of Milan, the Kingdom of Naples, the Kingdom of Sardinia, and the Austrian Netherlands would be inherited by a daughter, which was not the norm. 1781, the Patent of Toleration provided limited freedom of worship, which was approved in Austria. 1803, the U.S. Senate ratifies the Louisiana Purchase. 1818, the Convention of 1818 is signed between the U.S. and the U.K. that settles the Canada-United States border on the 49th parallel for most of its length. 1827, the Battle of Navarino. Combined Turkish and Egyptian fleets defeated by the British, French, and Russian naval forces in the last significant battle fought with wooden sailing ships. 1883, Peru and Chile signed the Treaty of Ancon, by which the Tarapacá province is ceded to the latter, bringing an end to Peru's involvement in the War of the Pacific. 1904, Chile and Bolivia signed the Treaty of Peace and Friendship, delimiting the border between the two countries. 1935, the Long March, a mammoth retreat undertaken by the armed forces of the Chinese Communist Party a year prior, ends. 1941, World War II, 1,000 civilians in German-occupied Serbia murdered in the Kragujevac massacre. It was between 2,700 and 2,800, mostly Serb men and boys in Kragujevac are murdered by German soldiers October 21st, 1941. It occurred in the German-occupied territory of Serbia. Came as a reprisal for insurgent attacks in the Gornjima Milanovic district that resulted in the death of 10 German soldiers and wounded of 26 others. The number of hostages to be shot was calculated as a ratio of 100 hostages executed for every German soldier killed and 50 executed for every German soldier wounded. This formula was devised by Hitler with the intent of suppressing anti-Nazi resistance in Eastern Europe. All it did was make things just worse. The 1944, World War II, the Soviet Army and Yugoslav partisans liberate Belgrade. Well, the telephone games have begun for the day. 1944, liquefied natural gas leaks from storage tanks in Cleveland and then explodes. It levels 30 blocks and kills over 130 people. Also in 1944, American General Douglas MacArthur fulfills his promise to return to the Philippines when he comes ashore during the Battle of Leyte. All righty. We've 1947. The House Un-American Activities Committee begins its investigation into the communist infiltration of the Hollywood film industry. It creates the Blacklist. It prevents some from working in the industry for years. 1951, the Johnny Wright incident occurs during a football game between the Drake Bulldogs and Oklahoma A&M Aggies. The Johnny Bright incident was a violent on-field assault against African-American player Johnny Bright by a white opposing player during the college football game held October 20th in Stillwater, Oklahoma. The game was significant in itself as it marked the first time that an African-American athlete with a national profile and of critical importance to the success of his team had played against Oklahoma A&M. The Bright's injury was also highlighted the racial tensions of the time and assumed notoriety when it was captured in what was later to become both a widely disseminated and eventually Pulitzer Prize-winning photo sequence. The 1952, the governor of Kenya declares a state of emergency and begins arresting hundreds of suspected leaders of the Mau Mau uprising. 1961, the Soviet Union performs the first armed test of a submarine-launched ballistic missile, launching an R-13 from a Gulf-class submarine. 1962, China launches simultaneous offensives in Ladakh and across the McMahon Line, igniting the Sino-Indian War. 1973, Saturday Night Massacre, U.S. President Nixon fires Attorney General Richardson and Deputy Attorney General William Ruckelshaus after they refused to fire Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox. He's finally fired by Robert Bork. In 1973, the Sydney Opera House is opened by Elizabeth II after 14 years of construction. 1976, the ferry George Prince is struck by a ship while crossing the Mississippi River. 78 passengers and crew die. Only 18 people aboard the ferry survive. 1977, a plane carrying the rock band Lynyrd Skynyrd crashes in Woodland in Mississippi in the U.S. 6 people, including 3 band members, are killed. 1981, 2 police officers and an armored car guard are killed during an armed robbery carried out by members of the Black Liberation Army in the Weather Underground. 1982, during the UEFA Cup match between FC Spartak Moscow and HFC Harlem, 66 people are crushed to death in the Luzhniki disaster. 1986, Aeroflight Flight 6502 crashes while landing at Kubashev Airport in Kubashev, which is now present-day Samara in Russia. 70 people are killed. 1991, a 6.8 earthquake strikes the Uttarkashi region of India, killing more than 1,000 people. 2003, the Sloan Great Wall, once the largest cosmic structure known to humanity, is discovered by students at Princeton University. 2011, Libyan Civil War. Rebel forces capture Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi and his son Mutasim in his hometown of Sirte and kill him shortly after that. Ends the first Libyan Civil War. 2017, the Syrian Civil War. The Syrian Democratic Forces declare victory in the Raqqa campaign. There's a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day. Aka of Hexham. Adderailed, Artemis, Capracius of Agen, Hedwig in Canada. It was moved from October 16th. Irene of Tamar, Magdalene of Nagasaki, Margaret Marie Alacoque in Canada, Marie Bertilla Buscarden, Mata Admirabilis, Arbor Day in Czech Republic, Heroes Day in Kenya, Revolution Day in Guatemala, one of the two patriotic days, Vietnamese Women's Day in Vietnam, World Osteoporosis Day, and World Statistics Day. All right. In 1097 on this date, the first Crusaders arrive at Antioch during the First Crusade. They're going to free the Holy Land from the terrible people that hold it. 1603, Chinese uprising in the Philippines fails after 23,000 people are killed. In 1803, Senate ratifies Louisiana Purchase. 1917, U.S. suffragette Alice Paul begins a 7-month jail sentence for peacefully picketing in support of women's suffrage. That's the right to vote, don't you know? She did the picketing at the White House. 1935. Mao Zedong came to prominence after the end of the Long March. Um, 2020, U.S. Supreme Justice Department sues Google for an illegal monopoly over search and search advertising. 1998, comedian Richard Pryor is awarded the first ever Mark Twain Prize for American humor. Let's see what else we got. Okay, 2005, Saddam Hussein pleads not guilty to opening of the Al-Dujail trial. During the proceeding, he argued the judges wasn't appointed by him. He didn't acknowledge the court. A tribunal of five Iraqi judges headed by Risgar Mohammed Amin will decide his sentence, including if he's liable for the death penalty. 1924, an earthquake rattles most of the state of South Carolina and the surrounding area. Is recorded in Pickens, Brevard, Walhalla, and Hendersonville. That had the highest intensity. 1927, a new electrical machine with a mechanical mind has been perfected at Massachusetts Institute of Technology by Professor Vannevar Bush, which can solve problems considered too complex for human engineers. The product is a differential analyzer and allows the mathematician or engineer to feed in the equation and parts of the problem that can't be solved by formal mathematics. The machine can take anywhere from 8 minutes to several hours to provide the answer, which man alone can't solve. 1952, the Subversive Activities Control Board recommended the American Communist Party be registered with the U.S. government and be forced to show its membership roster and financial records under the Internal Security Act in 1950. 1955, on this date, J.R.R. Tolkien's final book, The Return of the King, is published. It's the third fantasy novel making up the Lord of the Rings book series. It was written between 1937 and 1949. Books were set in Middle Earth and featured hobbits and wizards and elves and dwarves and orcs and men in the quest for the one ring that rules the other rings of power. All three books became movies. 1967, more than 10,000 protesters took to the streets of Oakland, California on the fifth day of demonstrations. It was protesting American involvement in the Vietnam War. On this day in 1968, Jackie Kennedy marries Greek multimillionaire Aristotle Onassis on his privately owned island, which is part of the Greek islands. 1973, Nixon fired Archibald Cox and abolished the Watergate prosecution force. 1983, Prime Minister of Grenada, Maurice Bishop, is killed by the armed forces at the Caribbean Islands military headquarters. 1984, Monterey Bay Aquarium, one of the largest aquariums in the world, opens in Monterey Bay, California. Among its many firsts, the aquarium is the only aquarium in the world able to keep a great white shark captive for more than 16 days. 1988, the British government announces plans to change the law regarding a suspect's right to remain silent, and a person's reason for remaining silent can be interpreted by a judge and jury to support guilt or innocence. The 1991, the Oakland firestorm happens on the hillsides of northern Oakland, California, kills 25, injures 150 others. The fire claimed 2,843 single-family dwellings, 437 apartments, and condominium units. In 1995, the UN was forced to take out a loan of $125 as it had exceeded its annual budget and decided to hand out bills to its biggest debtors. At the top of the list was the U.S. that owed the UN $1.25 billion. The announcement of America's debt was a sad moment for the country that had helped found and initially fund the UN. October 20th, 2006, a bus in Rewa, India drove into a lake after possibly experiencing brake failure. 56 people died. 9 were either rescued or able to swim to shore. 2007, Peeyush Amrit Bobby Jindal is elected as the youngest governor in the U.S. and the first Indian-American governor in the country. 2007, one of the largest and deadliest fires in U.S. history begins in Southern California as it's fanned by the Santa Ana winds. Destroys 400,000 acres and 2,000 homes. 2011, Greeks protest on the second day of a nationwide general strike against new austerity measures, including higher taxes and cuts to public sector wages. It's intended to alleviate the country's ongoing debt crisis. Riots break out, one man is killed, and 74 others are injured. 2012, Crown Prince Guillaume marries the Belgian Countess Stephanie de Lannoy in Luxembourg. Royals and regular citizens attend a special service at Notre Dame Cathedral celebrating the marriage the day after the civil ceremony took place. And in 2013, at least 19 people are killed at checkpoints in Nigeria's Borno state. Gunmen dressed as the military are identified as Boko Haram, but Boko Haram didn't confirm that. They reportedly stopped motorists and shot and killed them, which is considered, shall we say, antisocial. Okay, 1528, the Treaty of Gorinchem is signed between Holy Roman Emperor Charles V and Duke Charles of Guelders. 1536, King Christian III of Denmark and Norway leads a reform in Catholic possessions. 1576, Spanish troops occupy and plunder Maastricht. 1587, Battle at Coltrus. Henri von Navarra beats the Catholic League. 1600, Battle of Sekigahara sets Tokugawa clan as Japan's rulers, or the shoguns as they were called. 1634, British King Charles I disbands the new ship money tax. 1714, George Ludwig von Hanover, German, don't you know, is crowned as Britain's King George I at Westminster Abbey. It was his grandson, George III, that orchestrated the American Revolution. 1740, Maria Theresa becomes ruler of Austria, Hungary, and Bohemia. 1751, the royal ship Duc de Bourgogne launched at Roquefort. 1774, America's Continental Congress orders the discouragement of entertainment. 1786, Harvard University organizes the first astronomical expedition in the U.S. 1813, the German Kingdom of Westphalia is abolished. 1817, the first Mississippi showboat leaves Nashville on its maiden voyage. 1818, U.S. and Britain agree to joint control of the Oregon country. 1822, the first edition of the London Sunday Times is published. 1827, the naval battle of Navarino. Off the Peloponnese coast, English, Russian, and French combined fleet beat a Turkish and Egyptian force, paves the way for Greek independence. 1835, the HMS Beagle leaves Galapagos Archipelago to sail to Tahiti. That had Darwin on board, don't you know? 1843, the first Chinese immigrant arrives in Suriname. 1847, a 12-year-old English boy named William Nelman poisons his grandfather with arsenic. It became a famous court case. 1862, amnesty is proclaimed for escaped slaves in Suriname. 1880, Amsterdam Free University opens up. 1891, the first international six-day bike race at New York's Madison Square Garden begins. 1898, The NC Mutual and Provident Insurance Companies formed. 1899, Battle at Tallana Hill in Natal. British Army versus the Boers. In 1902, a Chamber of Deputies appoints a committee to consider questions on the separation of church and state in France. In 1905, a great general strike in Russia begins. It lasts for 11 days. That same year, Russian Tsar Nicholas II allows the Poles to speak Polish. That's to help quell the revolution in the Kingdom of Poland. 1908, King Leopold II sells the Congo to Belgium. 1906, Dr. Lee DeForest demonstrates his electrical vacuum tube, also known as a radio tube. 1928, Divine Alaska Airways Incorporated, the first airline in Alaska and one of the first in the U.S., is formed with Noel Wyman as president. He was an aviation pioneer. Well, we've come to the end of today's little history segment. We've been talking about threats and plots and assassination attempts on various presidents. Nixon, of course, was somebody who had everybody and their dog trying to kill him. When he made his trip to Russia, supposed that the KGB had orders to kill him. And the Soviets dreaded the possibility Nixon would defeat John Kennedy for president. So they had a contingency plan to kill him. So if he became elected, their plan was to shoot him. Now, there's so many stories that have come to light about the involvement of Oswald in assassinations that you don't know what to believe anymore. You know, by the end of the 1960s, Secret Service had doubled in size to 760 agents. And the uniform branch of the Secret Service had been expanded from 250 to 850 and given new responsibilities of guarding more than 130 foreign embassies in Washington. Secret Service Chief James Riley also brought in measures to improve the training of agents and created an intelligence system that included a computerized list of potential attackers. They were adding 100 new names a week to that. You know, as vice president, Nixon was scrupulously polite to his agents and very appreciative of everything they did. And as president, he was said to be courteous and even friendly, asking about their families or expressing concern if you heard about a problem. According to one former agent, Marty Vinker, Nixon treated his agents like human beings. He was the first to send flowers if somebody was sick. And his treatment of the Secret Service officers contrasted drastically with that of his predecessors. On one occasion, an agent accidentally blew the horn of the limousine that was parked outside Nixon's lodge at Camp David. Nixon himself opened the door and said, "Okay, boys, I'll be out in a minute." Johnson used to make agents wait anywhere from 10 minutes to 10 hours for him to decide to grace them with his presence. Now, according to his agents, Nixon was a private man. He believed his protectors are great guys who did a fine job, but he kept them at arm's length. And he admitted himself he never got familiar with the Secret Service. He said, "They've got a job to do, and I've got a job." The moment you get familiar with people, they start to take advantage. And Time magazine said his Secret Service detail was aloof and well-organized, just like Nixon himself. Now, there was a consensus among agents that Nixon was reckless about his own safety during his 8 years as vice president, 6 as president. According to Huey Baughman, Nixon has showed utter disregard for his own safety, had delusions of personal safety, and he was an assassin's dream. And he said Nixon came close to being killed on several occasions. And when he took office in January of 53, the vice president told Baumann he would accept Secret Service protection only when he was traveling outside Washington. He wanted only a small detail. Later on, though, he changed his views and allowed the Secret Service to assign him two men in Washington and more when he traveled. And they went on to say that Nixon was actually incorrigibly brave. When he became president, Rufus Youngblood said Nixon seemed oblivious to personal danger. And he had grandstand by standing on the door guard or roof of his limo and taunt anti-war protested with the V-sign. Nixon told one of his aides, that's what they hate to see. Well, in August of 73, Nixon tried to cut his detail in half, believing he was overprotected. He said, frankly, I think one man's probably as good against a threat as 100. And like other presidents, sometimes he did try to elude his agents. On one occasion, his valet drove him out of his home at San Clemente, California, which is known as the Western White House, without informing Secret Service. Nixon was in the back seat, covered up with a blanket. He wanted to go to a local restaurant without bodyguards or fanfare. Reporters spotted him, though, and told the Secret Service, who soon caught up with the president. When Nixon took office, the permanent detail consisted of 40 men, headed by Robert Taylor. Early in 57, Taylor accompanied Nixon on a trip to Africa and was one of Nixon's... Well, as you might guess, Secret Service quite often clashed with Nixon's staff, culminating in an incident that would lead to Robert Taylor being fired. At a 1972 Nixon campaign rally, Taylor had to deal with Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, who former agent Dennis McCarthy said was a power-hungry egotist to do anything in his power to turn the Secret Service to his own private police force. Haldeman wanted to drop the ropes holding back the crowd at the Providence, Rhode Island airport. When the president's plane landed, Haldeman planned for supporters to rush across the tarmac for a spontaneous demonstration. Excuse me. Taylor refused to allow it and even threatened to arrest Haldeman if chief of staff wouldn't help with the plan. Haldeman had to acquiesce to the Secret Service demands, but took his revenge by having Taylor fired from his position as head of Nixon's detail. Well, more than 100 people a year were detained by agents and uniformed officers at the White House during the Nixon years. Most were released without charge, but quite a number was sent to St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Secret Service ruled the detainees had to be mentally ill and dangerous to others or to themselves to be sent to St. Elizabeth's. But the staff there didn't always agree with the Secret Service decisions. One detainee, for example, believed one of Nixon's daughters loved him and went to the White House with flowers in hand. He was routed to St. Elizabeth. The director of General Admission said he wasn't dangerous and they wouldn't detain him. And the hospital's director of admissions, who challenged the Secret Service decisions, was supported by the hospital psychiatrist, who agreed that many alleged threateners shouldn't have been arrested. Well, you know, the Secret Service investigated numerous alleged assassination plots by left-wing groups during the Nixon years. Nearly all of them came to nothing. As David Greenberg acknowledged, the prevalent fear of assassination confounded clear-eyed distinctions between genuine and rhetorical threats. Radicals exploited the uncertainty to nettle authorities while authorities used it to harass radicals. Well, in 1969, the Secret Service discovered an alleged plot by Cuban terrorists to blow up Nixon's Key Biscayne, Florida home. One Cuban agent, Lazaro Eddie Espinoza Bonet, who was acting undercover as a Cuban diplomat, tried to recruit a Cuban-American servant inside the Nixon compound at Key Biscayne to draw up blueprints. The agents threatened to harm the servant's family who lived in Cuba, but if he didn't comply, the servant was told he'd be provided with microtransmitters, which he should plant throughout the Nixon home. Transmitters to be monitored by the Cuban agents in Miami or aboard fishing boats offshore. Allegedly, the blueprints were used to plan an attack on the compound by Cuban commandos. Well, the servant told Secret Service agents about the threats to him. U.S. State Department is convinced the plot was serious and they expelled that particular diplomat. Well, in October of 1969, the National Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence had been established by Lyndon I'm Going to Be King Johnson after Robert Kennedy's assassination issued a report that listed characteristics shared by most would-be presidential assassins. A disproportionate share of threateners, the report found, came from broken homes, had absent fathers, had withdrawn personalities, were unmarried or had failed at marriage, had an inability to hold down a job, expressed a zealotry for political causes. And it was also determined most suffered from some form of mental illness. In the years following the publication of the report, Richard Nixon would be targeted by six would-be assassins whose lives fit the report or profile in every respect. All these cases were considered to be extremely serious by the Secret Service and very nearly resulted in Nixon's death. June of 71, Secret Service discovered a plot to kill President Nixon while he addressed a convention of retired people in Chicago. Before Nixon's arrival, 47-year-old James Beavers, who lived in Squire, West Virginia, traveled there with the definite intention of attempting to do some kind of bodily harm to the president. That's according to Chicago Police Assistant Superintendent Howard Pearson. Beavers, who was a World War II veteran, he was a former mental patient who was known to be violent and always talked about guns and killing people, according to his sister. 1950, he was found guilty of murdering his sister's husband, committed to a West Virginia mental hospital. He owned two .32 caliber revolvers and told relatives in the weeks before he arrived in Chicago he was angry with the president's conduct of the Vietnam War, and he'd been recently arrested on a weapons charge. Well, shortly before Nixon's arrival, a woman noticed Beavers setting a revolver down on a salt box in Grant Park, which was near the hotel where Nixon was scheduled to address the convention. She told the police, and after the police rushed to the scene, they surrounded the armed man and demanded he hand over his gun. He refused and challenged the officers to take it away from him. As he began to walk away, he suddenly turned and fired and hit a police officer in the thumb. The other police officers opened fire and fatally wounded Beavers. 9 months later, Nixon was stalked by Arthur Bremer. Bremer wanted to do something bold and dramatic and forceful and dynamic. "A statement of my manhood for the world to see," he said. In fact, statements at the time of his trial indicated he simply wanted to be a celebrity. Well, Bremer decided around March 1st of 72 to assassinate either the president or Alabama Governor George C. Wallace, who'd been campaigning around the country in Democratic Party's presidential primaries. "According to what Bremer wrote in his diary, life's only been an enemy to me. I'll destroy my enemy when I destroy myself. But I want to take a part of this society that made me with me. I chose to take Richard Nixon. Now I start my diary of my personal plot to kill by pistol either Richard Nixon or George Wallace. I intend to shoot one or the other while he attends a campaign rally in the Wisconsin presidential primary. I'm one sick assassin. I have to be within spitting distance of Nixon before I can hit him. Got to think of something cute to shout out after I kill him, like Booth did. Nixon's the one, and how?" When Bremer learned that President Nixon was scheduled to meet with Pierre Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister in Ottawa, April 13, 1972, hastily flew back to his hometown of Milwaukee and collected his two pistols and ammunition and began to make his way to Ottawa. When he got to Ottawa, he discovered through newspaper reports the motorcade route into town and drove up and down it to get familiar with it. Bremer attempted to get into Uplands Air Force Base, the military airport Nixon was scheduled to arrive. According to what Bremer wrote, "From the very beginning of this plan, I planned to get him at the airport as he was addressing a happy Canadian crowd. Bremer dressed in his conservative business suit, wore a Vote Republican badge, put one of his guns in his pocket and felt added confidence in a suit, short hair, and shaved. But at the airport, Bremer was told there were no facilities for the public. So he left the airport and found a vacant service station along Nixon's motorcade route. He waited in a chilly drizzle for 40 minutes to an hour. He said, 'My fingers got numb, and I thought that wouldn't do.' So he sat in his car to warm up and then drove up and down Nixon's motorcade route for 2 hours. Surprised the police didn't stop him in his easily identified Denny Blue Rambler car with the yellow Wisconsin license plates. He found a place to park and stood waiting with a pistol in his pocket, fantasizing about killing Nixon by shooting over the shoulder one of the police officers who lined the motorcade route into the city. Well, Bremer was uncertain if the bullets from his revolver would go through the glass of Nixon's limo. He said, I didn't want to get killed or imprisoned in an unsuccessful attempt. I can't afford to do that. Well, when Nixon's limo appeared, it went by too quickly for him to get off a shot. He said, I had a good view as he went past me, and still alive, he went before I knew it, like the snap of the finger. Went back to his car, believing the best way to make the attempt was over, and you can't kill Nixie boy if you don't get close to him. Well, Bremer made a second attempt to get near Nixon during the president's visit to Ottawa's Parliament Hill, April 14th. As Nixon, Bremer had been captured on a Royal Canadian Mounted Police video standing near Ottawa's eternal flame. As Nixon was prepared to leave Ottawa's legislative building after addressing the House of Commons, Bremer saw what he thought to be the presidential car and immediately went to his hotel to get his gun. He confessed he stupidly took time to brush his teeth and change his suit. When he came back, the car was gone. Well, Bremer would later learn that Nixon's security was especially tight that day due to the fear of anti-war demonstrations. Bremer cursed the demonstrators for foiling his assassination attempt, and after 3 days of foiled plans, he gave up and went back to Milwaukee. After considering shooting presidential contender George McGovern, he decided to assassinate George Wallace. He wrote in his diary, I've decided Wallace will have the honor. He shot Wallace during a campaign rally for the presidential candidate in Laurel, Maryland, May in 1972. Well, when the police searched his car, they discovered two books about Robert Kennedy's assassin, Sirhan Sirhan. Bremer spent 35 years in prison and was released on parole in Maryland in 2007. 3 months after Bremer shot Wallace, the Secret Service investigated an assassin-for-hire case in New York City. Andrew Topping was a 27-year-old, well-off investment banker and right-wing radical whose wife had recently committed suicide. When the police came to his apartment to investigate the suicide, they noticed Topping had several guns, including a .45 Webley, the same type Topping's wife used to kill herself. Topping was arrested and charged with firearms violation, but released on his own recognizance pending trial. A week before his arrest on gun charges, Topping, who blamed pro-rightist forces beyond his control for his wife's death, made a request for an appointment to see Nixon. This prompted the Secret Service to interview him and carry out a background check. Short while later, one of Topping's acquaintances arrived at Secret Service offices in New York and told agents Topping had asked him for assistance in finding an assassin who would kill the president. Well, the Secret Service arranged for one of their undercover agents, Stuart Henry, to pose as an assassin for hire. On August 10th, Agent Henry and the unnamed acquaintance met with Topping at Central Park Boat Basin in New York City. After negotiations, Topping gave him $1,000 and made it clear the money was to kill Nixon. The assassination was planned for the following week. Well, as soon as the money changed hands, Topping was arrested and taken to a local police station. He was charged with threatening and attempting to kill the President of the United States. During his court appearance, he was ordered to undergo mental tests, and he was sent to prison for his crime and returned to New York City after his release. He died in 2006. Well, that same month, the Secret Service began a manhunt for Ralph DiStefano, an Atlantic City resident who had written to Nixon threatening his life. DiStefano had previously been arrested for threatening President Johnson. Part of DiStefano's plan, which he outlined in his letter to the president, was to drive to Key Biscayne, Florida, where he believed Nixon was vacationing. In fact, Nixon was at his San Clemente, California residence. Breaking during his journey south, he checked into a motel near Savannah, Georgia. And while he was in his room, a Chatham County police officer was checking car registrations in a motel's car park and discovered DiStefano's car, which had been the subject of a police all-points bulletin. When the police arrived at the motel, they arrested DiStefano and found a .32-caliber pistol and 40 rounds of ammunition in his motel room. 1973, a man described a former agent, Marty Vinker, as an Illinois man, sent a letter accompanied by drawings in which he showed how easy it would be to kill Nixon at a rally. Well, the Illinois man lived about 30 miles from Peoria, Illinois. He was put on a watch list when Nixon planned to visit to Pekin, Illinois via Great Peoria Airport. Secret Service asked local police to watch him at all times and until the president left the region. Well, on June 15, 1973, the Illinois man drove to the airport shortly before Nixon's plane landed. When he parked his car, a police officer noticed a high-powered rifle on the back seat and arrested him. According to Marty Vinker, the Illinois man said he'd been heading out on a hunting trip and got lost. Well, nobody believed him, and but as the Secret Service didn't have any real grounds to hold him, he was released. Vinker believes that a real threat of assassination had been filed that day. Unfortunately, the Illinois man sued Vinker and was awarded an out-of-court settlement. Samuel Bike was one of those rare would-be assassins to make direct threats against the president before putting their assassination plan into effect. He was a failed businessman who blamed Nixon for all his failures. He's also fascinated by Mark Johnny Essex, who used a high-powered sniper rifle to kill six people before he was gunned down by New Orleans police. Essex's slogan on his apartment wall, "Kill Pig Nixon," had great meaning for Baku, according to Professor James Clark. Bike had been investigated by the Secret Service in 72 for threatening the president. No charges were brought against him. On Christmas Eve, 1973, he picketed the White House as Santa Claus, carrying a sign that read, "Santa says all I want for Christmas is my constitutional rights to peacefully petition my government for redress of grievances." In 1974, less than a week after Robert Preston was shot by police after landing a helicopter on White House lawn, the 44-year-old Bike carried out a plan he called Operation Pandora's Box. It called for him to hijack a commercial airliner and crash it into the White House. Early on February 22, 1974, he sent newspaper columnist Jack Anderson a tape describing his plan to kill the president. Listening to the tape, Anderson heard Bike say, "I'll try to get the plane aloft and fly it toward the target area, which will be Washington, D.C. I'll shoot the pilot and then at the last few minutes try to steer the plane into the target, which is the White House." Later that day, Bike went to Baltimore Washington International Airport carrying a pistol and a gasoline bomb. Forced his way onto a Delta flight destined for Atlanta by shooting a guard at the security checkpoint. Entering the cockpit, he ordered the crew to take off, but after they informed him it was impossible to depart without removing the wheel blocks, he shot the pilot twice and the co-pilot three times. Co-pilot died instantly. Police outside the airplane shot into the cockpit and hit a Bike twice. After falling to the floor, he put the revolver to his own head and killed himself. In August of 74, House of Representatives ruled that impeachment proceedings could go ahead against Nixon after it was discovered he'd lied about his role in the Watergate cover-up. He resigned as president on August 8, 1974. Threats to Nixon's life continued even after he left office, including a kidnapping plot organized by al-Qaeda in 1993 aimed at winning the release of Muslims being held in federal custody in connection with the World Trade Center bombing. That plot was revealed in an informant. Imad Salim taped a plotter who admitted he planned to kidnap plot at the suggestion of terrorist al-Sayed Nasser, who had been convicted and imprisoned for terrorist acts. Nixon and former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger to be exchanged for the release of Nasser. In 1995, Ali pleaded guilty to conspiracy to wage a war of urban terrorism. Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the leader of Sadiq Ali's terror group, and 10 others were found guilty of the World Trade Center bombing and other acts of terrorism. Despite the 37th president's many accomplishments, the Watergate scandal tarnished Nixon's presidency. Though entitled to lifetime Secret Service protection, he gave it up in 1985, and he died in 1994. Well, the next president to face threats was Gerald Ford. He was the only politician who served as vice president and president but was never elected to either office. And of the nine vice presidents who filled a vacant presidency, he was the only one who hadn't been elected. In my opinion, he was given the vice presidency as a reward for his involvement in the Warren Commission. He was appointed and confirmed as vice president in October 73 when Spiro Agnew resigned after pleading no contest to a charge of income tax evasion. And after Nixon had resigned, a year later, he became president, took the oath of office August 9, 1974. He was described as open and straightforward as Nixon was tightly controlled and conspiratorial. Newsweek reporter Thomas DeFranco knew Ford for 30 years, said he was the most remarkably guileless political figure he'd ever known. DeFrank said Ford had the impulse hardwired into his DNA like nothing else to be a nice guy. Describing himself as a Ford and not a Lincoln, the new president told an uneasy nation, "Our long national nightmare is over." And he'll forever be remembered for the way he restored public confidence in the White House and in the executive branch of government after the damage Watergate had inflicted. During his 895 days as president, he had to deal with inflation, a recession, high unemployment, and energy crisis that caused long lines at gas pumps around the country. He also addressed numerous foreign policy crises and oversaw the conclusion of the Vietnam War, which ended in defeat with the fall of Saigon in April of 1975. According to former agent Joseph Petro, foreign Secret Service agents were surprised at how affable the new president was, and they considered him a truly nice man. A little clumsy because he kept tripping over stuff, but a nice guy. Dennis McCarthy said Ford was very popular at the White House detail and a man who was exactly what he appeared to be. A nice guy trying his best to do one of the most difficult jobs in the world. A job he had not been elected to. And Ford had a generous nature, according to Marty Vinker. When agents were shivering outside at Camp David, Ford would sneak him an egg sandwich when the boss wasn't looking. He'd wink and say, "Boys, it's cold out here. I'll get you a cup of coffee." He also saw humor in having a security head who looked very much like himself. According to Marty Vinker, whenever Dick Kaiser exited Air Force One ahead of the president, the clouds would applaud. Well, on the night of Nixon's resignation speech, Ford met agent Joseph Petro and realized the agent was new to his detail. Ford shook his head and said, "I'm Jerry Ford." Petro thought to himself, "This man is 2 hours away from becoming the president of the United States and has the presence of mind to introduce himself to me." When Ford moved into the White House, the first reception he organized was for his vice presidential protection detail and their wives. After that, he took them on a tour of the White House. Maybe the only criticism agents had of Ford was that he was cheap. Agents told author Ronald Kessler Ford never even had pocket change for a newspaper, and at his country club in Rancho Mirage, California, he'd tip caddies a single dollar when the going rate was 25. Well, Ford's public image was that of a bumbler who bumped his head on the door of the presidential helicopter, Marine One, stumbled down the Air Force One steps, and managed to hit spectators when he played golf. But his Secret Service detail saw a different side to him. Agents said the president was an expert skier who taunted agents who couldn't keep up with him. When a lighthearted act of revenge, his detail found an agent who was an expert skier. The agent would ski backward and wave as the president tried to keep up with him. August 14, 1975, Ford was traveling in his presidential limo after giving a speech in Hartford, Connecticut. As Ford's motorcade drove through the city, local motorcycle police officers blocked side streets by leapfrogging as they passed each intersection. At one intersection, though, motorcyclists leapt ahead too early, and a car driven by 19-year-old James Salamites came through on a green light and smashed into the president's car. Agent Andrew Hatch, the president's driver, swerved sharply and avoided excessive damage to both vehicles. Republican State Chairman Frederick Bible's hand was injured in the accident. Ford was thrown to the floor of the car by the impact, but he wasn't hurt. Agents fearing an assault on the president ran to surround the limousine, and Salamites, who appeared to be in shock, was arrested and questioned. He was released a few hours later when Hartford police realized he wasn't blamed for the accident. Ford was the target of repeat offenders such as Thomas Elbert, who had spent 5 years in prison for threatening the life of President Nixon. Shortly after being released for that crime, Elbert telephoned the Secret Service office in Sacramento and said, "I'm going to kill your boss, Ford." Elbert was arrested August 17th after people at a gospel mission said Elbert had been bragging about his threats. He got another five-year sentence. 1974, President Ford became the target of a Muslim fanatic, Marshall Hill Fields. Fields turned to Islam after his father's death from cancer. He planned a disruptive action against the U.S. government for Christmas Day, 1974. The agency had received a letter in which Field explained his conversion from Christianity to Islam, declaring, "If it's God's will, I'll renounce my citizenship to this country December 25th, 1974, and if it's God's will, I'll be out of this country to seek political asylum in one of the countries now known to be a member of the Third World." He said he wanted to deliver a copy of the Quran to President Ford. Agency, of course, put him under investigation. About 6 a.m. on Christmas Day, Fields drove west in his two-door brown Chevrolet Impala and started to make what White House guards said was a U-turn. Instead, he rammed the car through the wrought iron northwest gate and drove up to within 20 feet of the front door of the executive mansion. He gunned the engine, stepped out of his car before threatening to set off sticks of dynamite taped to his body. Told the Secret Service he was the Messiah. Agents with high-powered weapons hiding in nearby bushes and behind pillars of the portico withheld their fire. and a standoff ensued during which Field said he wanted to talk to Shahbazada Yaqub Khan, the Palestinian ambassador, the Pakistan ambassador to the United States. When I asked staff called the ambassador, they were told he'd never heard of Fields. Confrontation continued for another hour before Fields asked that his demand to see the ambassador be broadcast on the Howard University radio station. Well, that demand was met, and after he heard the broadcast on his car radio, he surrendered. Agents immediately searched Fields and discovered his bomb was actually made of highway flares. Later, Secret Service officials said they probably have shot Fields if Fords had been in the White House. Fields was taken to St. Elizabeth's Hospital for psychiatric examination. He was sentenced to 18 months in jail for destruction of federal property after a jury deadlocked on the question of his sanity. A week later, a copycat threatened and tried to drive into the White House. He was arrested after a scuffle, and the Secret Service sent him to join Fields at St. Elizabeth. Although Ford went in the White House during the incident, he'd been skiing in Vail. They highlighted the extreme danger the president faced by non-mentals or mentally ill attackers, as the agency described them, who were determined to breach the presidential security. Between 1974 and 1976, there were many White House intrusions that were taken very seriously by the Secret Service, although they involved no direct threat to the president's life. Thanksgiving night, 1975, Gerald Gaines Jr. scaled the White House wall, hid undetected for 2 hours, and got within reach of the president's daughter, Susan Ford, as she was unloading camera equipment from her car. 10 days later, he again climbed the fence, said he wanted to ask President Ford to pardon his father, a convicted heroin smuggler. The next year, White House uniformed officer Charles Garland fatally shot Chester Plummer, a 30-year-old intruder whom Garland had told 3 times to put down a 3-foot metal pipe he was holding in a threatening manner. Officers thought that pipe was a bomb. December of 76, Stephen Williams rammed the White House Northwest Gate on Pennsylvania Avenue with a pickup truck. He suffered cuts and bruises, was arrested, and charged with destruction of government property. Williams shouted at reporters as he was led away, trying to link him up before he kills us all. 1975, Ford was the target of a plot organized by 32-year-old Gary Stephen DeShere and 24-year-old Preston Mike Mayo. DeShere was a violent, mentally deranged escapee from a Montana mental hospital who'd sent threatening letters to President Ford in 74. He made plans to rob an armory to steal guns and dynamite to be used for the assassination plans. After his escape, DeShere was picked up hitchhiking by Mike Mayo, an ex-convict from Virginia. Well, DeMayo and DeShere wanted to kill Ford because he was for the rich and they were for the poor. The plan involved robbing a San Francisco armory to get dynamite, guns, and a sniper telescope. DeShere would create a diversion by bombing a sewer near the state capitol building. Mayo would make sure and then fire a shot at Ford. But on August 19th, the two men were stopped by California Highway Patrol at Burbank. When an officer approached their car, they took off at high speed. The officer followed but was unable to stop the fugitive before they dumped their car at the Hollywood Burbank Airport in Los Angeles. Foolishly, they left written details of their plot in the car, which the police found. The sheriff and Mayo arrived in Santa Barbara August 24th and booked into a motel. They planned to drive to San Francisco to rob the army, but was arrested August 26th when Santa Barbara Police Detective Robert Zapata was called to the motel to investigate the theft of a color TV set, for which they later pled guilty and were given 90 days in the county jail. The plot unraveled the day after their arrest when DeShere confessed the plot to Detective Zapata, who had been informed of the written assassination plans of would-be assassins left behind in her car. March 6, 1976, in the Los Angeles District Court, the two men were found guilty of planning to assassinate President Ford. The day of the planned DeShere Mayo plot to kill President Ford, Lynette Squeaky Fromm, a disciple of hippie leader Charles Manson, left her apartment in Sacramento, concealing a pistol under her dress. She planned to assassinate Ford. Now, if you remember, Manson was a cult leader who'd masterminded 2 brutal Hollywood home invasions, left 7 people dead. Fromm had met Manson on the boardwalk in Venice Beach in 67, the year she graduated from high school. Estranged from her family at the time, she was invited to join Manson's family of young women who were devoted to him and saw him as a charismatic, Messiah-like figure. He affectionately called Fromm Squeaky for her high-pitched voice. When Manson was sent to San Quentin prison after being found guilty of murder, Fromm made veiled threats against the judge's children and blamed political leaders for Manson's guilty verdict. She was especially angry at Richard Nixon, who proclaimed Manson guilty even before the trial ended. Fromm said Manson had told his father as he was mad at Nixon. Ford was just another Nixon, she insisted. Now, Fromm had a long criminal record, but had been convicted only on minor charges. On the morning of Ford's visit, she decided she'd kill him. She said to herself, maybe I'll take the gun. I have to do this. This is the time. About 10 a.m. on the morning of September 5th, 1975, she joined a group of spectators lining the route that President Ford would take from his Sacramento hotel to the state capitol building. He was going to meet Governor Jerry Brown and give a speech on crime and gun control to a joint session of the California legislature. Ford's motorcade was waiting for him, but it was a beautiful day, so he decided to walk to the capitol. After recognizing the cheers of a small crowd outside the hotel, he headed into the park area and began shaking hands with people lining the walkways. Well, these type of impromptu interactions by the president always create a lot of tension in the agents, according to Agent Larry Budoff, because we're not going into an environment that's controlled. We don't like to do that, but the media, they're running with their cameras and they're trying to watch the president, watch the crowd. People start shaking hands. You know, sometimes they hold on too long and you're busy trying to keep the crowd away. There's so much going on. As Ford walked through the park, he noticed a lady in a very vivid red dress sort of walking with me as I walked toward the cap, and all of a sudden I went to shake hands. It was Skrinky Fromm, and she was about to reach for her .45 automatic. Fromm said the president had his hands out and was waving, and he looked like cardboard to me. As she pointed a gun at his stomach, she said, the country's in a mess. This man is not your president. Ford recoiled, put his hands up, and hunched over. And one bystander said he looked alarmed and frightened. When 27-year-old Linda Warlaw saw the president in Fromm's hand, she fell to the ground. That alerted Ford's agents. When Agent Bundorf saw a hand coming up with a gun, he stepped in front of the president as Fromm was pulling back on the slide. He hit the gun and stopped the slide and pulled the gun up to his chest. He managed to get his thumb between the hammer of the .45 and the firing pin. She's screaming, I've got the gun and I've got her and I'm not letting go, so I just pushed her away from the president. The president's going in one direction, I'm going in the other, and she tries to run and I pulled her back. She goes down on the ground and I pull out my cuffs. I cuffed her and yelled out to an agent. The agents covered her and they were gone. Fromm was led away by agent. She shouted, easy guys, don't batter me. The gun didn't go off. It didn't go off. Can you believe it? It didn't go off. Well, Fromm tried to kill Ford because she told reporters, if Nixon's really wearing a new Ford face, continues to run the country against the law, our homes will be bloodier than the Tate LaBianca homes and Malai put together. Manson wrote to us and he said he was mad at Nixon and we should explain why. Manson family's been locked up for 5 years for Nixon's conspiracy. The whole country was and still is dying in Nixon's thoughts. He walks loose after he dealt people's blood, lied and ruined the economy and sold us out. Well, when Manson prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi heard about the assassination attempt, he wasn't surprised. He said Fromm's actions were completely within the family's lifestyle to kill or attempt to kill people in such a way as to shock the world. I'm not surprised, not surprised at all. And on that note, with that quote from Bugliosi, we've come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow and talk some more about threats and plots and assassination attempts against the president. Until then, Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.